On December 28th, 1958, the Baltimore Colts beat the New York Giants 23-17 in overtime to win the NFL championship. The game, played at Yankee Stadium, is commonly called the greatest game ever played and is widely credited with popularizing pro football. The following year, the Colts would beat the Giants again in the 1959 NFL championship game. In just one decade, attendance had increased from 25,000 people per game to 40,000 per game. At this point, professional football, which was considered a niche sport in 1950, appeared ready to challenge baseball for the title of America's number one game. But all was not perfect with the NFL in 1960. The league's commissioner had just died, and the upstart AFL was about to present the NFL with its biggest long-term threat in the history of the league. Welcome to the debut episode of the Definitive History of the NFL, Episode 1, 1960, The Foolish Eight.
In 1959, there were only 12 NFL franchises in 11 cities. In the East, we had the Giants, the Eagles, the Colts, the Steelers, and the Washington Professional Football Club. In the Midwest, the Bears, the Chicago Cardinals, the Lions, the Packers, the Browns, and out West, the 49ers and the Rams. The Chicago Bears were hammering the Chicago Cardinals every year. And the owners of the Cardinals, the Bidwell family, who still own them today, had had enough. They wanted to move to St. Louis, but they couldn't get the NFL to agree to it. Lamar Hunt, son of H.L. Hunt, possibly the richest man in America at the time, tried to buy the team. Hunt's attempt to purchase the team was rejected by the NFL, and the NFL did not want to expand beyond 12 teams. And so Hunt put together a group to start a new league, alongside a few people, such as Bud Adams for the Oilers, whose family still owns the Tennessee Titans today, Bob Housem for the Broncos, etc. Others in the group included Billy Sullivan of the Boston Patriots, a weirdo broadcaster named Harry Wismer, who took over the New York Titans, the Baron Hilton of the Hilton family for the Los Angeles Chargers, and Ralph Wilson for the Bills, and a group led by Bill Boyer in Minnesota. This group of eight owners called themselves the Foolish Club.
As the AFL is finding teams, the NFL starts panicking. So they allow Minnesota, which had tried to become an AFL team, to move to the NFL and become an expansion team in 1961, the following year. And Dallas was added as well as an expansion team. This would be the Cowboys. They were actually moved up and they would start in 1960. They also eased the ropes on allowing teams to move, and they let the Chicago Cardinals move to St. Louis, where they would stay until 1988 when they moved to Arizona. So Minnesota bails, and now they need an eighth team to start the AFL. They can't have an odd number of teams. So Chargers owner Baron Hilton, who's Paris Hilton's grandfather, wants a West Coast rival in the league, which is primarily East Coast based. And the league eventually picks the Oakland Raiders, who's owned by a guy named Chet Soda. Little known fact that I didn't really see anywhere in my research, but found it in like an old newspaper article, that the Atlanta Falcons were heavily considered to be the eighth team. They were beat out and they would start a couple years later. Minnesota they would start in the NFL a couple years later. Correct. Minnesota actually drafts for the 1960 AFL season. They do basically an expansion draft for the entire league, and then they bail, so they have a whole roster, and Oakland takes all of their players. This wasn't the first time that a league had really started up as an NFL rival. In 1926, the AFL. In 1936, the AFL. 1940, the AFL. They're all called the AFL, except the most successful of the previous entries, which was the AAFC. From 1944 to 1950, famously dominated by, who dominated Chester?
The Cleveland Browns.
The Cleveland Browns, that's correct. So they pick a commissioner, a guy named Joe Foss, the number one Marine fighter pilot from World War II. He was also the governor of South Dakota. What really got the AFL going and got them noted in the sports media was they signed 75% of the NFL's first-round draft choices. They got the AFL beat the NFL out for them by offering more money, including, most importantly, Houston getting Heisman Trophy winner Billy Cannon, who was picked number one in the draft by the Rams.
Who just died.
Just passed away, I think, like a month ago, right?
Yeah.
It took a long court case, and the ruling allowed Cannon to play for Houston, which was good for him because the Oilers offered him $100,000. The Rams offered him $50,000. The AFL was full of a lot of interesting coaches. The LA Chargers had Sid Gilman, Well, I think it was Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Isn't he like a famous Jewish coach? Yeah. The only coach in both the NFL and College Hall of Fame, and his coaching tree is responsible for 26 out of the 52 Super Bowl wins. The Titans went with a big name in Sammy Baugh. Didn't really work out. The Titans are now the Jets. The Bills went with Lou Saban, who I had thought was Nick Saban's like grandfather or something, but it's believed that they're second cousins. Lou Saban, I think it's worth reading all the places that Lou Saban coached, because he is really like the itinerant, like jack of all trades, coached everywhere. So here's where Lou Saban was a head coach: Case Tech, Northwestern, Western Illinois, the Boston Patriots, the Buffalo Bills, University of Maryland. Again, this is all head coaching positions. Denver Broncos, Buffalo Bills, the Miami Hurricanes, Army, UCF, then he goes to high school, Martin County High School, South Fork High School, Georgetown High School, Middle Georgia Heat Wave. I don't know what that is, but they don't have a Wikipedia page. Peru State College. You know, what state is Peru State College in?
Peru, like the country?
It's, but it's not in the actual country. Where is Peru State College?
I have no idea.
It's in Peru, Nebraska. Tampa Bay Storm of the, I'm not even sure what league. That must be an an arena team. Milwaukee Mustangs, SUNY Canton, and then he finished at Showen University, which is in Murfreesboro, North Carolina, in 2002.
How old was he last time?
He was at 80, and he died a few years after that. But not Nick Saban's son, or not Nick Saban's dad or grandfather, but a distant relative. The Chiefs, going back to the coaches, hit a home run. They picked Hank Stram, probably the least sexy of the choices, a college assistant. Probably ended up being the best coach of this bunch. The Oilers picked Lou Rimkus, a very strict coach who threatened to whip his players and was fired despite winning the title, spoiler alert, in 1960, after starting slow the next year. The Broncos had Frank Filchak, who became, in 1939, the first QB ever to throw a 99-yard touchdown pass. But he's best known for being suspended from the NFL for 4 years because there was a crazy gambling scandal in the 1946 NFL championship. And he was accused of throwing it. It's not totally clear if he threw it, but he was definitely approached by mob guys to throw it and was suspended for 4 years. He was unsuspended, but it was too late for him to really get back in the league. The other two coaches were Buster Ramsey for the Bills. He was the Lions' defensive coordinator, who's credited with inventing the 4-3 defense and blitzing linebackers. And last but probably least was Eddie Ertelatz of the Raiders, who coached the Navy in the entire 1950s. And then he coaches the Raiders in 1960. First two games in 1961, the Raiders get outscored 99-0, and he quits. It was super. Even though they were spending a lot of money on players, it was still super rudimentary back then in terms of travel and like technology for actually like learning the plays. And so they would watch projected film onto a white sheet, hopefully a clean one. The league was basically made up of bums who couldn't make the NFL for the most part, but some of those players ended up being really good. So Don Maynard, Len Dawson, two Hall of Famers, were two of the castoffs.
There's a great story in Smithsonian Magazine about Charlie Hennigan, who was coaching a Louisiana high school team and teaching biology when the Oilers offered him a tryout. He had never had a shot in the NFL. He played a tiny Northwestern State College in Louisiana. He signed with the Oilers in 1960 for a $250 bonus and a $7,500 salary. "I was so happy," says Hennigan, "I was going to be making as much as the principal at his school." He kept a pay stub from his $270 a month teaching job in his helmet as a reminder of what he'd go back to if he failed. He didn't. Hennigan may be the most prolific receiver not in the Hall of Fame. In 1961, he would set a single season record for reception yards that stood for 45 years. In 1964, he would become the second receiver to catch more than 100 passes in a season with 101, a record that would last almost 40 years.
A late cut from the Denver Broncos training camp, Charlie McMahon, tries to give us an idea of what the AFL in the beginning days were like. He said they would have auto mechanics, farmers, stock clerks, and high school football coaches, of which McMahon was one, and Hollywood stuntmen. They would basically come out of the woodwork and try and get a chance to play pro football where they had not been able to play in the NFL. Some were cut, and others fled in the night, and another batch would be brought in the next morning. George Blanda points out there's only 12 NFL teams with 33 players per team. So when the AFL began, even though a lot of the guys on the roster, especially the back end, were bums, there were a lot of good players out there compared to maybe nowadays where you'd have 32 times 53. Some of the teams played at major American stadiums, like the Chargers played at the L.A. Coliseum because they were the L.A. Chargers in 1960 before they would move to San Diego in 1961. And the Dallas Texans played the Cotton Bowl. But then there were teams like the Boston Patriots that played at Boston University's Nickerson Field.
By the way, just an editorial comment here. Charlie Hennigan was good, but to me, the best receiver not in the Hall of Fame is a wide receiver from that very same era in the AFL prominently who played for your New York Titans and then the Oakland Raiders, and that's Art Powell.
Yeah, there are a bunch of guys who are not in the Hall of Fame from that era. I think the argument against them was like a lot of these guys really did flop out of the NFL. So it's sort of and the AFL was such a passing centric league. Yeah. That, you know, that it's sort of coarse fieldish stats. But yeah, no, Art Powell was great. A bunch of there's a website like rememberTheAFL.com, which they like advocate for like 60 different guys to be named to the NFL Hall of Fame. So the AFL has a lot of innovations that, you know, they really were much more progressive as a league than the NFL in the early going. So 2-point conversions, the first among all the pro leagues to have those. Player names on the back of the jerseys, which if you watch old NFL footage doesn't exist. ABC would televise the games with multiple cameras. CBS was just one boring 50-yard line like camera. So if you watch the old like 1950s games with the Colts or the Browns, they are pretty unwatchable. But once you get to the AFL games, they're actually semi-watchable. The scoreboard clock would keep officials as opposed to the ref keeping the time on the field. The scoreboard clock would keep the time. Soccer still has not innovated to have someone who's, you know, policing 22 people not be the timekeeper. And they were also more progressive towards integration. I think every team is immediately integrated, whereas a team like the Washington Pro Football Team, who would have known that they were racist back then, still did not have a black player in 1960 or 61. Until 1962, they had no African-American players. Attendance, even though the league was buzzworthy early on, was not nearly in the NFL's planet. The Raiders were under 10,000 fans a game, and they were really basically about to go under. And Ralph Wilson, I think, was like notoriously cheap, but maybe back then was a little bit more friendly. Gave the Raiders like a really large loan so they could continue. So the league didn't have an odd number of teams. And the other innovation, the AFL went straight to 14 games, so every team could play each other twice, whereas the NFL was stuck at 12, which is kind of too few and short-sighted and not enough money, hosting only 6 home games. But the NFL immediately, like a lot of progressive organizations, forcing like the old guard to change their tune. They immediately go to 14 games in 1961.
Yeah. One of the stupid things about the AFL is with everybody playing everybody twice, there was effectively no divisions. And yet they still did have 2 divisions officially, and the winners of each division played each other in the championship, which means you could have had this idiotic circumstance. Fortunately, we did not, where the 2 teams with the best record would have been in the same division, and one of them would not have played in the championship. Now, again, that did not happen, but it was
right. There was no reason for divisions if there's a balanced schedule. It's although yeah. I mean, some of the college football, I guess nobody's really playing everybody twice in any of the college football leagues that have divisions. But yeah, I agree.
And they don't even play everybody once anymore, the leagues that have divisions. You know, they can't play everybody once because there's not enough games. All right, let's get to on the field.
Okay.
So, yeah, as you said, the AFL was instantly a much more vertical game than the NFL. Comparing the stats in 1960 to both leagues, there was only one player in the NFL that year with 900 receiving yards and only 2 players who had more than 52 catches. But in the AFL, there were lots of guys who were putting up numbers that would even make a Pro Bowl today. Lionel Taylor, for example, on Denver, put up 92 catches for 1,235 yards and 12 touchdowns. Bill Grohman had 72, 1,473 yards and 12 touchdowns for Houston. And the Jets, the Titans, soon to be the Jets, tandem of Don Maynard and Art Powell, the aforementioned Art Powell, combined for 141 catches, 2,432 yards and 20 touchdowns. The Jets would not have a pair of wide receivers to top those figures until 2015. When Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker would combine for more catches, yards, and touchdowns. But nevertheless, despite the vertical game, QB stats were actually bad. No quarterback in the AFL had a quarterback ranking of even 72. And those that were good had been castoffs in the NFL. George Blanda, for example, had been the Bears' kicker and backup quarterback throughout the 1950s. Desiring to play QB but limited by George Halas to kicking, Blanda angrily retired from the Bears in 1958. When the AFL formed, he quickly joined the Oilers as both quarterback and kicker, and although he was derided by the sports media as an NFL reject, he would lead the Oilers to the first 2 AFL titles. In 1961, he would be the league MVP, leading the league in yards and touchdowns with 36. 36 touchdowns in a season, a number that would not be matched by any quarterback in the AFL or NFL until Dan Marino in 1984. The following year, Blanda would throw an even more impressive 42 interceptions. 42 interceptions in a season. I would argue that that number is less likely to be broken than the post World War One record of 31 wins in a season for a baseball pitcher. Kiva, what would have to happen for a quarterback to get 42 interceptions in a season today?
I mean, first of all, in terms of 31 wins, I have a baseball team where we have a pitcher who gives up zero runs every start and has four wins on the season. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I think, 42 interceptions. What if a guy had, there was just no backup and a guy had, 50 touchdowns and 42 picks? I think Eli Manning could, in theory, have, 37 interceptions in a season.
But how would he not get benched? That's the crazy part.
Let's say his backup was Geno Smith.
Yeah. So while those receivers were putting up monster numbers, running backs were not. Abner Haynes led the league in rushing with 875 yards and 9 touchdowns. He was also fifth in receptions, first in all-purpose yards, and second to Groman in yards from scrimmage. By the way, that means that a wide receiver led the league in yards from scrimmage. That's crazy. Julio Jones did it in 2015. The last time before that, the receiver led the NFL in yards from scrimmage was 1952. But in the AFL, it was quite common. Bill Groman in 1960, Charlie Hannigan in 61 and 64, Lance Allworth in 65 and 68, Warren Wells in 69, which really shows how different of a game the AFL was. Groman also led the league in approximate value, the football version of war, just ahead of the QBs, Al Doro for your Titans, future Senator Jack Kemp and vice presidential candidate, and three defensive players, which were the DB Mark Johnston for Houston. He went undrafted in the NFL, only being all-pro in his rookie season in the AFL. And Dallas teammates, defensive end Mel Branch, and middle linebacker Cheryl Hedrick, who once broke his neck in a game and refused to come out, earning the nickname Psycho.
Hockey players would never do that.
Yeah. With those players leading the league in approximate value, who's the MVP? So I would say that Errol Dorrell for the Titan Jets was probably the best quarterback in the league. He had a league-leading 26 passing touchdowns, a 76 Chester quarterback ranking, and his touchdown-to-turnover ratio of 33 to 31 was not bad at the time. Again, this was an era when there were more interceptions than touchdowns. Jack Kemp went 9-3 and led the league in completion percentage and total yards and was second in touchdowns in Chester quarterback ranking. But he and Dora were also number 2 and number 3 in turnovers. So I'm going to give the award to Bill Groman. The best receiver for the championship team, he led the league in approximate value. And although a wide receiver MVP is rare, I certainly think that he deserved it that year. To be fair, though, of course, we don't really have any defensive stats other than interceptions. So it's hard to know how good any specific defensive player was. So Dallas, and remember, we're not talking about the Cowboys. We're talking about the Dallas Texans, who would move 1 year later, was actually the best team in the AFL that initial season. They started the season 2-4 with their losses by 1 point, 2 point, and 1 point. After three straight blowouts got them above 500, they lost their last two games in November on the road at Boston and then New York on Thanksgiving, dropping them back below 500. Needing to win out to have a chance, they did, with an incredible run that saw them outscore their opponents 82-7, which included a 24-0 shutout of the eventual champion Oilers. But it was too little too late, because the Chargers, who started the season 2-3, won 8 of their last 9, avoiding the close losses that hurt the Dallas Texans. They beat Dallas by 1, Houston by 3, Denver by 4. Their 4 losses were by an average of 23 points, so when they lost, they'd get blown out. That included a home-and-home with the Raiders, which they swept, moving them from 6-4 to 8-4, and which eliminated the Raiders, who fell from 5-5 to 5-7. The worst team, meanwhile, in the West was Denver, who started 4-2 and then never won another game. In the East, Houston had no competition, and they clinched the division in Week 12. They went 10-4, and they probably could have been better. Other than the 24 shutout at the hands of Dallas, which was the week after they had clinched, their 3 losses were by a combined 5 points. The rubber match between Houston and L.A. came in the AFL Championship on New Year's Day. Just like the NFL Championship, which we'll get to a little bit later, the losing team would score 2 early field goals to take a 6-0 lead, only for the ultimate winner to score 10 straight in the second half. In the second quarter. In an otherwise quiet game, my league MVP, Bill Groman, would pull what would prove to be the winning touchdown in the third quarter to take a 17-9 lead. The Chargers scored late in the third to pull within 1, but Billy Cannon, that rookie we talked about, would have an 88-yard touchdown catch and run in the fourth quarter to clinch the Oilers' victory in the inaugural AFL Championship.
All right, so the Oilers win the championship, and Bud Adams, being probably one of the stingier owners in league history, decides not to have a ring made for the players after their first championship season. So instead, according to Dr. Steve Hennigan, who's Charlie's son, he gave them championship fobs. Now, I don't really know what a fob is, but I know I should know what a fob is. So I shouldn't have said that. What's a fob?
I have no idea.
Well, I think we should both know what fobs were. Anyway, we don't know what fobs are. to be determined what a fob is. Hashtag, tell us what a fob is. So several years later, he was so embarrassed, he ends up giving rings to the 1960 players. Hagstrom's son, Dale, who was good friends with Billy Cannon, says that Cannon and Adams, who hated each other, so when Bud Adams tried to give a ring to Billy Cannon, he said, no way, I'm not taking it. And he sent it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it's still there today if you want to go see it. So that's the AFL 1960. But let's talk about the senior circuit for a second. So in 1959, during the season, Commissioner Pete Bell goes to a game and gets sick and basically like leaves the game, goes to the hospital, and dies. So now the league has no commissioner. And in January 1960, they realize, like, all right, we need a commish. We have this rival league that's you know, is trying to take us on. Like, we really need to be in good hands. This ends up being the most pivotal, you know, sort of one of the more pivotal moments in the history of the league. You know, if they made the wrong choice here, the league could have just lost to the AFL. But they end up hiring, you know, I think inarguably probably the best commission in league history. So how do they pick Roselle? It's a wild story. So January 20th, 1960, they meet. And there's 12 owners. Each owner has a vote. In order for the new commissioner to win, they need 8 votes out of 12. They need a 2/3 majority. The problem is the Bears owner, George Halas, is basically not voting because his big issue is not, he doesn't care who the commissioner is. He wants expansion, and he doesn't want to, for whatever reason, upset any of the owners. So he decides, like, I'm going to be Switzerland. I'm going to sit out almost every vote, which means you need an 8-3 majority. So because there are two rival factions, this gets really ugly. So first, the interim commissioner, who the NFL has had very bad luck hiring interim commissioners or basically de facto deputy commissioners as commissioners, because that's what Roger Goodell is. But Austin Gunzel is the name, is sort of the favorite, and he's the interim commissioner. They put up him, and there needs to be a second guy in the ballot. So the Niners, like attorney Marshall Leahy, ends up beating him 7-5. So they realize, okay, our guy is going to be problematic. He's not going to be able to win. So now they bring up the Colts GM. Colts GM, Don Kellett versus the Niners guy, Marshall Leahy, and now it's 7-4. They keep doing this again and again. 8-3, 7-4. There's a group of Art Rooney, who's the Steelers owner, and George Preston, Frank McNamee, and Cal Rosenblum, who's the Colts owner, who big issue is they don't want the league offices moved to San Francisco, which of course they end up moving to New York. And Halas is still abstaining. They vote about 30 more times. They bring up a zillion guys. This guy, Sam Harris, who's the GM. The former executive of the Chicago Cardinals, Ray Benningson. A bunch of million more guys you've never heard of. The baseball commissioner, Happy Chandler, gets mentioned. The Detroit Pistons general manager gets mentioned. Random lawyers. I mean, you could have been commish if you were back then. None of these guys are able to win a vote. Day two, day three, they just keep voting and cannot have an 8-3 vote. They go back to the original votes of, like, Leahy and Kellett. Still, nobody wins. Then they go back to Gunsel. Nobody wins. Finally, Wellington Mara, the Giants owner, and Paul Brown realize that their candidate will never win, and they say, okay, the GM of the Rams, Pete Rozelle, he was sort of the peacemaker in the room to try and keep it calm. Why don't you join the ballot? And he wins right away 8-3 on, I believe, the 23rd or 24th vote on day four of this never-ending election. And the white smoke comes out. Rozelle is the commish, and he's going to move the league office from Philly to New York City. Do you want to guess how much Rozelle's contract in 1960 was to be the commissioner?
$25,000.
Not a bad guess. It was $50,000, and they realized right away he's good. They bumped him up to $60,000 with a $10,000 bonus. So Pete Rozelle, now entering the 1960 season, is the young commissioner of the NFL. The NFL, unlike the AFL, which was sort of hiring retreads and mediocre college coaches, listen to the ridiculous lineup of NFL coaches just in the West. I'll only go through the West because there's 12 teams. Let's just do there's 13 teams now because the Dallas Cowboys are starting. Here are the six NFL West coaches. Vince Lombardi, 5 titles, 2 Super Bowls. George Halas, 6 titles. Tom Landry, the Cowboys are now an expansion team, but they would one day make 12 straight NFL/NFC title games, and he also won 2 Super Bowls. The Colts coach was Weeb Eubank, who won, I think, inarguably probably, the 2 most significant games in NFL history, the aforementioned 58 championship, and then the January 12, 1961 Super Bowl III for the Jets. Then the lesser-known coaches, the George Wilson of the Lions, best coach in Lions history because he won the 57 title with them, still the Lions' most recent championship. Where are the Lions on your sad franchise ranking right now? Because that is kind of pathetic. 1957, there's 12 teams. They couldn't have stolen a title back then.
Yeah, it's pretty pathetic.
Then Red Hickey, not very well known, but the Niners coach invented the shotgun offense.
You want to know where the Lions are? The Lions are number six right now.
And who are the top five?
Indians, Vikings, Bills. The Eagles got themselves off the list. They won the Super Bowl. So the Lions are up to number five.
Up to number
Indians,
five.
Vikings, Bills, Jazz.
And the Indians could knock themselves off this year, maybe. Red Hickey invents a shotgun offense, and he's like the least impressive coach of this entire group. And then the Rams coach was Bob Waterfield, who is not really well known for being a coach, but was the 1945 NFL MVP. He's in the Hall of Fame, right? I think he's a Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we had a big argument about him in our quarterback rankings. I think
Have a big fight about him. Yeah. Also, I was really disrespectful to the guys from the 1940s. Anyway, he was a bad coach, and he later became a rancher, and he's now long since dead. The only really notable coach in the NFL East was Paul Brown, who won seven titles with the Browns, which in hindsight seems impossible.
Yeah. All right, now let's get to some of the stats that year in the NFL. While we said the AFL was throwing the ball up and down the field, the NFL was much more divided. You had the Packers, who led the league with 29 rushing touchdowns. No other team had even 20. The Lions, meanwhile, as a team, threw six touchdown passes. As a team. The Browns' defense caught as many touchdown passes, they had six pick sixes, as the Lions' offense. And by the way, the Browns, in addition to those six pick sixes, they only threw five picks total. So the Browns were a really, really good team. We'll get to that. The rest of the league averaged 23 interceptions. So only throwing five the whole season, as the Browns did, was really, really good. The Lions' six touchdowns on the season could have been worse. Jim Nanowski, their starting quarterback for the first 10 games of the season. You want to hear his touchdown-interception ratio? 2-18.
That's
not
bad.
Great, Bob. Yeah. In their ninth game, they actually beat the Packers, who would end up winning the division. Facing elimination in the 10th game, losing badly in the fourth quarter to the reigning two-time champion Colts in Baltimore, they benched Nanowski for Earl Moore.
What do you think would happen if we brought like Nathan Peterman from 2018 into the 19th? Like, would he be good then? Like, would he have just thrown 30 touchdown passes?
He would destroy the league, for sure.
Okay.
Human evolution. Earl Morrill, who once had a run-in with your grandfather.
I think my wife's grandfather, yeah.
Oh, your wife's grandfather. He comes in off the bench to replace Nanowski. Earl Morrill, what a weird career, always coming off the bench. He promptly throws as many touchdown passes in that quarter as Nanowski had thrown in the entire season, sparking a crazy comeback. The Lions come back, win the game. They're 5-5, and now only one game behind the Colts and the Packers atop the division. This Lions team, by the way, despite that 2-18 ratio of touchdowns and interceptions from their quarterback, they were 5-5 because they had a defense filled with legends. Alex Karras, Yale Larry, who was also a great punter, Joe Schmidt, Dick Knight, Train Lane. They finished the season on a four-game winning streak with Morrill leading them to wins in their last two games by a combined score of 59-14. And I would argue that if they had benched Nanowski earlier, they probably would have been in the championship instead of the Packers. Now, let's get to that division. Now, as I said, the West featured the Baltimore Colts, who had won the previous two championships and were seeking the first three-peat in the NFL since the 1929-31 Packers. Of course, the Browns won five in a row between the AFC and the NFL in the late 40s.
Of course.
Johnny Unitas was considered the best quarterback since Otto Graham had retired. They had Hall of Famers up and down the lineup. They started the season 6-2. On a clear collision course with the East winner, which we'll get to in a second. They're coming out of their bye with a two-game homestand in which they can clinch the division. In Week 10, they blow a fourth-quarter lead to the 49ers, despite Johnny Unitas having 356 yards and three touchdowns. But he had five interceptions. The next week, they blew a fourth-quarter again, thanks to Ormoral's crazy comeback for the Lions that we just mentioned. Unitas had another monster game with 357 yards and two touchdowns, but again, three picks. Suddenly facing a must-win, the Colts get humiliated the next week in Los Angeles, 10-3. The offense did not show up. The defense obviously was pretty good. They only gave him 10 points. And finally, in the last game of the season, they complete their four-game collapse, getting blown out by the 49ers. Unitas throws three more picks. In total, over the final four games of the season, he had 12 interceptions, and the three-peat is not to be. Meanwhile, the Browns, the best team in the league, best offense by a mile, best defense in the division, best advanced stats, they go 8-3-1 in the East, but that puts them a game and a half behind the Eagles, and there's no playoffs back then. The two division leaders meet for the title. And so the Browns are not even going to make the playoffs. The Packers squeak by in the mediocre West with the collapse of the Colts, but they were probably much worse than the Browns and also the Eagles. Bart Starr on the season, Hall of Famer Bart Starr, 4 touchdowns, 8 interceptions.
Wow. He's like the Joe Namath of his day.
Yeah. Well, look, no, he didn't have to throw much because he had two Hall of Fame running backs, Jim Taylor and Paul Hornung, but still, those numbers are not great. The Browns, as I said, best
shouldn't his two Hall of Fame running backs like help him have, like, that's not an excuse for him to have 4 touchdown passes and 8 interceptions.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe they just never throw inside the 10.
Yeah, when the league is averaging 23 interceptions per team, 8 is pretty good.
Yeah.
And he only had 4 touchdowns because they ran it 29 times for touchdowns. As we said, no other team had even 20. The Browns were led, as I said, by the best player in the game, Jim Brown, led the league in rushing. He had more rushing yards than the champion Eagles would have as a team. In fact, I would argue the Browns had the two best running backs in the league because alongside Brown was Bobby Mitchell, who finished sixth in receptions, 11th in rushing, and 5th in yards from scrimmage, and he and Brown both had 11 touchdowns.
What's crazy is that, remember the Redskins' Bobby Mitchell was also like Mr. All-Purpose. Like he was more of a kick returner, but he was also a backup running back. Yeah. So
I should do a Bobby Mitchell ranking one time. Yeah.
You really should.
So meanwhile, the Dallas Texans are running away with the first championship in the AFL. In the NFL, the Dallas Cowboys, who shared the Cotton Bowl with them, were the worst team in the league. They went 0-11-1. In professional football history, to that point, the only teams that had gone winless in a season in which they played at least 8 games were the 1925 Columbus Tigers, big fan of the Tigers, who went 0-9. That year, by the way, there were 5 teams in the NFL who did not win a game, but the others played fewer games. It was an unbalanced schedule. For example, the Duluth Kellys that year went 0-3.
It's like Alabama never played anybody, but like literally teams just couldn't. Yeah.
The Duluth,
you know,
the Duluth Kellys went 0-3. The Frankfurt Yellow Jackets played 20 games. So yeah, I don't know who.
That's,
who
I mean, you see that sometimes.
If Alex Chester was in charge of the schedule that year, it would not have been that unbalanced. I can promise you that. The 1944 Brooklyn Tigers were another team to go 0 for the season. They were so bad they would be folded out of existence after that season. You know what's weird, though? The Brooklyn Tigers, they were called the Brooklyn Dodgers, matching the baseball team, the same way that the Giants and other teams did. And then they were called the Dodgers forever. They switched to the Tigers for 1 year. They go 0-11, and then they fold. So I guess the Tigers was bad luck, which makes sense because Tigers are from Detroit, where the Detroit Lions, who, of course, went 0-16 in 2008, they went 0-11 in 1942. And the final team was the Chicago Cardinals, who went 0-10 in 1943. And then the next year, the Cardinals actually would combine with the Steelers. It was World War II, so there was limited bodies.
A super team.
Yes, and the Chicago Cardinals-Pittsburgh Steelers super team would combine to go 0-10. So those were the only teams to, through that point in history, to have a winless season. So the Cowboys were very, very bad. Eddie LeBaron led the league with 25 interceptions. Not good. Meanwhile, let's get back to the Colts for a second with Johnny Unitas. He would throw the ball to Raymond Berry, who was more dominant at receiver than Brown was at running back. He had 74 catches, and we said, you know, in the AFL, that might not have been that amazing, but in the NFL, nobody else had more than 52. He had 1,300 yards. No one else even had 900. So Raymond Berry has 74 and 1,300, second in the league in both catches and yards with Sonny Randall, who had 62 and 893, although Sonny Randall did have 15 touchdowns. Paul Hornung, as we said, had 15 touchdowns rushing for the Packers. He was also the best kicker in the league. He did not miss an extra point. He was only one of two kickers not to miss an extra point all year. He was also second in the league in field goals. So Paul Hornung, kicker, running back, Hall of Famer. John David Crow was the David Johnson of 1960. His name was David. He played for the Cardinals. He led the league in yards from scrimmage, and nobody cared except for fantasy owners. How many people played
fantasy
football?
Did he also miss the year? No, literally zero. Did he miss the year in 1961 like David Johnson, just horrifying all of his fantasy owners?
Yeah. Well, every single one of there was not a single person who owned him in fantasy who was not disappointed in 1961. We'll leave it at that.
That's true.
So the Philadelphia Eagles, as we said, would win the title that year, but they get killed by the Browns in week one. They barely beat the garbage expansion Cowboys in week two. They win their next 4 games by 2 points, 4 points, 2 points. So, you know, they're getting very lucky, but all of a sudden they keep winning. They end up 9-1. They clinch the division. The Browns, who we said are the much better team, but the Browns go 5-3-1 at that point. And so the Eagles actually clinch the division. And what's interesting to me is that the Eagles and Browns both lost that season. For the Eagles, the only loss on the year in Pittsburgh. And the reason I say that's interesting is because although now we see Pittsburgh as being a great team, for the first 50 years of the NFL's existence, the Pittsburgh Steelers were what the Cleveland Browns are today. They were far and away the worst franchise in the league. And that year, their only 2 wins were against those 2 great teams, against the Eagles and the Browns, until late in the season.
It's funny because the Steelers had the same owner family then as they do now.
Yeah, well, it's funny that they
went from good to bad. I guess they realize if you never fire your coach, you become a good organization.
Eventually, yeah. The Giants started that season 5-1-1, but their season would fall apart in late November, including a tie to the otherwise perfectly whatever the opposite of undefeated is Cowboys. Washington had a very strange season. They beat Dallas in week 2, and then they had consecutive ties, which means through 4 weeks they were 1-1-2.
Yeah, it's like a hockey record back in the day.
And then they lost every one of the remaining games.
So what was their final record? 1-9-2?
1-9-2, that's correct.
That's a really ugly record.
Yeah, now the Bears, that's another team with a really weird season. They split quarterback duty between Ed Brown and Zeke Bratkowski.
If your name is Zeke Bratkowski, you're immediately like a backup quality player.
Well, but hold on. So Brown started all but one game, and then Bratkowski would come in and finish the games. Now, Brown had 7 touchdowns, 11 interceptions, and a 40% completion percentage. So you're going to ask me, why was he starting? Why didn't they just give it to Zeke? Well, Zeke had 6 touchdowns and 21 interceptions.
The closer.
So why was he playing at all? And the crazy part of all this is that the Browns were actually 5-3-1, half a game behind the Colts and a half game ahead of the Packers. So this QB platoon was working. And then the Bears lost 41-13 to the Packers. And then facing a must-win the next week in Cleveland, they lost 42-0 as their quarterbacks combined for 7 interceptions. Mm. And then the final week of the season, they lost 36-0. So they went from half a game out of the title to being outscored 119-13, which is really amazing. Yeah. So now, as we said, the Browns, the best team, but you know, because of those close losses, they do not win the division, and there's no playoffs. And so the Eagles go into the championship as a heavy favorite against the Packers. The Packers settle for 2 field goals from Paul Hornung in the first half, take a 6-0 lead. The Eagles score twice in the second quarter to take a 10-6 lead. In the fourth, Bart Starr, 4 touchdowns the whole regular season, throws a touchdown pass to give the Packers a 13-6 lead. But then the Eagles march down, score the winning touchdown, 17-13. Norm Van Brocklin's 5th game-winning drive of the season.
Well, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Because we did a lot of you did a lot of the stats research for this.
Yeah.
Did you make that stat up yourself, or did you see that somewhere, that he had 5 game-winning drives on the year?
No, I didn't make that up. That's a stat pro.
Okay, fine. Because I would be very impressed if you just like, hey, that's he had a lot. Yeah, and the Eagles become the first team ever to beat Vince Lombardi team, the only team ever to beat a Vince Lombardi team in a championship game. The Eagles were considered a very mediocre champion. Even then, it was sort of widely acknowledged that, like, okay, the Colts had a down year, the Packers were a pretty good team, and the Browns were probably the best team. Because if you look, first of all, this whole game is available on YouTube if you want to watch it, the 1960 championship game, which I did. I like watched the first beginning, and then I watched the fourth quarter.
Well, hell, so let me ask you a question, because this I couldn't find on Pro Football Reference, and I didn't watch the whole game. When did Van Brocklin throw that game winning touchdown to win the game? How many minutes were left?
I want to say like 8 minutes left, but I'm not. It might have been a lot less. I mean, it's also there's no clock on the scoreboard.
That's
because
true.
It's 1960.
You have no idea how much time.
Because like the Packers are driving, and I'm like, ooh, even though I know they lose, I'm like, ooh, this is getting exciting. And then they complete the ball in the middle of the field a couple times, but then call timeout. And then they're like clearly out of timeouts at a certain point.
Yeah.
And so they complete the ball down like inside the 10-yard line, and they're running, and then just the game is over. Like they threw the ball in bounds with not nearly enough time left. But so it was really acknowledged then that like the Eagles were really a crappy champion. It would be funny if like, because it was also sort of like, what if the 2018 Eagles end up being a bad champion? Like I like starting here where the Eagles are winning, and then we're up to a season in real life where the Eagles won, and they were like, the Eagles won this time with a backup quarterback. I don't think they're going to be viewed as a bad champion, the 2018 Eagles, but the 1960 Eagles were definitely considered like, well, we won. Like, you know, even then it was very clear that this was sort of like a mediocre team.
And we'll get to that in a second. What if there was playoffs back then? Would they have still won?
Yeah. I think so Chuck Bednarik is their star linebacker of the Eagles, right?
Yeah.
And so midway through the season, Bednarik their starting guard goes down. Bednarik's like, all right, he was 34, 35. He's like, you're going to play both ways, Bednarik. So he literally plays the entire game. And it was a little after people were doing, like back in the day, everyone was doing that. But by 1960, people were a little more specialized. You might be a kicker or a punter, but you weren't playing every single snap because players were much better at this point and they were big. So you could really get her. Anyway, Bednarik's a monster. There's this crazy story where he lays out in an Eagles-Giants game, I guess it was, he lays out Frank Gifford, the future Monday Night Football announcer and husband-slash-ex-husband of Hoda's assistant on the NBC show. So he lays him out, and they, like, cart him off like nobody's ever seen before. And then they go into the locker room after the game, and in the locker room, there is a guy with a sheet over it. And they're like, oh, my God, Chuck Bednarik actually murdered Frank Gifford. His hit was so hard. And then they realized, like, it was a fan in the first row had a heart attack. And they just, like, brought him to the doctor in the locker room. But he was dead. But they literally all thought it was, when they walked in the locker room, they thought, like, Frank Gifford was dead in the locker room. But, yeah, no, Chuck Bednarik was, like, I'm sure now he would like, not be able to play high school football. But back then he was, like, an actual murderer, Chuck Bednarik. Like, you like, literally ran away from him.
So who should have been – I said that I gave the AFL MVP to a wide receiver. Who should have been the NFL MVP? In actual fact, Norm Van Brocklin, who, as I said, led the Eagles on that championship-winning drive in the fourth quarter of the NFL championship, he was a contested MVP across all 4 MVP award organizations at the time. But to me, I have Milt Plum, his ball protection, making him the most valuable quarterback in the league that year. Milt Plum had 23 touchdowns and only 6 turnovers. By comparison, Van Brocklin was 24-21. Unitas was 25-28. Unitas led the league in yards, touchdowns, completions, attempts, and had just one fewer. But he had just one fewer interception than Eddie LeBaron for the Cowboys. Milt Plum led the league in rating by a ridiculous amount. His rating was 110.4. Van Brocklin was second at 86.5, and no one else was above the 70s. 1960 is also a great year for us to start. It's the first year that approximate value is available. In 1960, you look at the approximate value, that's almost a perfect replacement for my MVP ballot. Jim Brown first, Jerry Norton second. Who's Jerry Norton? Led the league with 10 interceptions, also led the league in punting with 45.6 yards per punt. He also played running back, and he was a kick returner and a punt returner. Next come John David Crow, Bobby Mitchell, Raymond Berry, and then Norm Van Brocklin, and then Paul Hornung and Unitas and Mo Plum. So those five comebacks are why Van Brocklin won the award. And but I'm going to say that while Van Brocklin won the championship, while Mill Plum was great with the stats, to me, it was a running game in the NFL that year, and the best player in the world was Jim Brown, and so Jim Brown should have been the MVP. So the only remaining question we have is, we have the Philadelphia Eagles winning because, as we said, the Browns, the best team, didn't even get a chance because there was no playoffs. What if there had been a Super Bowl? So the way we're going to do it is we're going to put four playoff teams in both the AFL and the NFL.
Mm.
And then we're going to use a modern format where the one plays the four, the two plays the three, and let's see what happens.
Now, is this like Super Bowl -7?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So in the NFL, the number 2 seed Packers would have almost certainly lost to the number 3 seed Browns. Now, who gets the 4 seed? The 49ers and Lions both finished at 7-5. They split their games. They have identical records against the division, which is also against common opponents, is the same thing that year. The tiebreaker, assuming we're transporting modern rules to 1960, would be strength of victory. So I had to go through this and check. Detroit would have made the playoffs ahead of San Francisco because their 7th victory was against the 8-win Packers, while the 49ers' 7th victory was against the 4-win, 1-tie Rams. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The Eagles would have beaten either one of those teams. They had already beaten Detroit 28-10 earlier. The Eagles and Browns would have met in the real NFL championship, and I would say that the Browns probably would have won. So who would the Browns have played in that inaugural -7 Super Bowl? In the AFL, the tiebreaker for the 1 seed would have come down to point differential because everyone played everyone twice, so there's absolutely no way to do any schedule-related tiebreakers. The Oilers, as the 1 seed, would have beaten the Titan Jets for the 3rd time that season. The Texans would have beaten L.A. on the road. With Houston facing Dallas in an all-Texas AFL championship, I like the team with the great offense and the great defense over the one-dimensional Chargers. Thus, in our inaugural Super Bowl -7, I have the Cleveland Browns against the Dallas Texans, neither of whom even got to participate in the playoffs in 1960 in real life. Considering the fact that most of the AFL players in 1960 were either undrafted in the NFL or were back of the bench, I say the Browns would have won that game by 40. And the best part of this exercise is it takes away the Eagles' only NFL championship prior to this past
season. Yeah, let's take away their 2017 title now also. Patriots should have won. The Eagles cheated.
Yeah. So the Texans, by the way, even though they dominate the AFL, and the Cowboys stink, the Hunt family could not take competing in one city with an NFL team, and so they actually go ahead and move to Kansas City the next year to become the Kansas City Chiefs.
Teams were really trying. They didn't think that there was a market to have two, and there probably wasn't, to have two teams in a city, right? Dallas splits up. The L.A. Chargers move immediately to San Diego.
Yeah.
And I think only the Rams are there at that point, right? Because Oakland is – the Raiders are in Oakland. And as we said, Chicago loses their second team. And so you have New York with two teams, but and that would become, if we ever do a merger episode, we have there's a really big there's an interesting solution to how the Titans, then Jets and Giants sort of end up coexisting. Anyway, aftermath of the 1960 season. So Norm Van Brocklin, who, if you aren't aware, still has the record for passing yards in a game with 554, which he did way back in 1951. It's kind of insane that record has held that long. Tom Brady's almost broken it in the last two Super Bowls just alone. So after winning the title, Van Brocklin retired. Now, he had already retired in 58 because he hated playing for the Rams, so the Rams agreed to trade him to Philly. And the coach there, Buck Shaw, lets Van Brocklin run the show. He's essentially a player coach. He's calling his own plays, Van Brocklin. He is essentially the offensive coordinator. So then, after 1960, he wants to retire and be the coach for the Eagles, but he thought they let him coach because Shaw's retiring. They don't. So then he goes to your expansion Vikings. We got to get in as many Vikings mentions as possible. And he totally flops there for a bunch of years, then goes to the relatively new Atlanta Falcons franchise and has very little success with either team. Really was not a great coach for in either scenario. And there isn't really a rich history nowadays of like excellent quarterbacks becoming good coaches. Anyway, you have anything else on 1960?
Yeah, the last thing I'm going to say, it's a visual medium, so it's not very helpful, but I'll G-chat to you and you try and describe it. The Cardinals, in their first year moving to St. Louis, their logo was phenomenal that year. Would you like to describe what their logo looks like?
Yeah, I don't. It's like a cardinal running with the football under a gateway arch. It's amazing. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, but it's a muscular football player with the head of the head that's still their logo to this day. Actually.
Yeah, it's probably like John David Crow just with a Cardinals upper body. Like he's jacked. It's amazing.
Yeah. And then the only logo I like even more than that, because this isn't even a logo, is the 49ers logo that year. Would you like to describe that?
Well, you got to send it to me.
I did.
Okay, fine. So it's like a Western, an old Western guy who's shooting a gun, which has like a poofy cloud of dust. His cowboy hat has fallen off. He's wearing red checkered pants. What is in his left hand? Is it a grenade?
No, it's another gun.
Oh, it's second gun, but it's upside down. It's an upside down gun.
He looks like he's mentally disturbed.
Could you imagine like in San Francisco now if you had like this logo? I feel like. I mean, I guess it's not like especially racist. It's just a guy who loves guns, who's got two guns and a cowboy's hat.
Yeah, I guess so.
Was San Francisco considered like the Wild West still in 1960? I don't know.
I guess so. Yeah,
but
it doesn't say a team name anywhere. It doesn't.
No. There's no reason to like if I, like I didn't even realize you sent it because there's no reason to know that this is the 49ers. Like maybe there's 49 boxes on his checkered pants. I'm not sure. But yeah, the logos were great. We could put them on. One other random fact I realized when watching the 1960 championship game on YouTube. When the announcers would say, like, all right, he's, like, snapping the ball for a kick, they would call it a pass. Like, the center passes the ball to the holder, who then holds it for the kicker.
I just taught my son about snaps yesterday, by the way. So my dad, who was, a pretty serious football player in his youth, when he taught me how to play football.
Nobody knew that.
Yeah. When he taught me how to play football, he would, like, when I would be the center, he would be the quarterback, and he would slap my ass so hard with the back of his hands to snap the ball to him. And I would like fall down giggling every single time because when you're a kid, that's like the funniest thing in the world. So I just taught it to my son this week and I paid it forward and I taught my son how to snap the ball and he could not stop laughing at me, slapping his tushy.
Would you let your son play organized tackle football?
No. Tackle football, no. At this age, never. For sure not. No.
Is he an athlete? I don't think you're going to have to worry about it anyway.
Yeah. If he exhibited like tremendous talent as like a flag football player, then we can discuss it as he gets into his teen years, but almost certainly not. Yeah, if he was hypothetically good enough for it to matter, then he'd be good enough in other sports also.
Yeah. So. All right. So just to give some credit, where credit's due, some references for this podcast. We did some research. Obviously, footballreference.com was invaluable. But Ed Groover's book, The American Football League: A Year by Year History, 1960-1969, was really good. Remember the AFL.com has some really good stories. Smithsonian Magazine with that anecdote in there. If you want to hear more of this, let us know. And if you never want to hear this again, then this could be a one and done thing. I think this is fun. I had a good time here.
Yeah, it's fun for us. But aren't you the one who said a couple weeks ago on the podcast that if you try and tell your grandkids about sports from back in your day, how are they?
Yeah, but think of it like Dan Carlin's hardcore history. Like I don't care about like the Incas or the Mayas, but like if he tells it in like a narrative like series, like then maybe it's interesting.
Yeah,
I don't know if he talks about the Incas and the Mayas, but I think it goes a little older school.
All right, are we going to discuss any personal anecdotes, or we'll save?
No, not on this show. This is a standalone episode. People are going to be listening to this 50 years from now when there's no more tackle football, and they're like, "Ooh, I want to hear about football."
Listen, in 2060, people are going to want to find like where can I find a 100-year-old description of the inaugural season of the AFL? So,
right, I do think we picked the right year. I think we definitely picked the smart year to start, 1960, because everything too old.
You wanted to find a year without the Vikings, so I couldn't talk about the Vikings. So,
right. If we do another year, 1961, so I guess the options are never doing this again. Doing literally every year, or we could do chunks like 1961 to 19, the rest of the pre era, before the Super Bowls, and then the Super Bowls into the mergers, and then who knows? And once we get to the more modern years, maybe it's more interesting. I don't know. Let us know what you think. I tell you an embarrassing story that actually has nothing to do with this? So you ever watch a YouTube video and at the end, like the YouTube person's like, let us know what you think in the comments, or like if you like this, give it a thumb up. Right?
Okay.
Your kids never watch you. Oh, you don't let them watch anything, right? So you don't even know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
So anyway, so there was a YouTube video. My son loves watching, like, how do they make, steel? I don't know, like, how do they make? He loves that stuff. So there was a person at the end. They're like, if you like this, give us a thumbs up. And then I was, like, watching. He was watching on my laptop on my bed. And, like, he I'm looking at him with the corner of my eye. And he sticks his thumb up. And he gives the lady on the screen a thumbs up.
That's cute.
It's cute, but maybe he could be an NFL player. Like, maybe it won't matter if he
it's not a big loss.
If he takes a few hits. We'll be back next week with something else.
Bye.
Cruising through El Paso, can a heavy load.
Bobby Fuller died for your sins.
And a cop shoots a kid on a hot summer morn.
Bobby Fuller died for your sins.
I could be anywhere when I hear that sound. Take me back, pretty baby. And jumps.
Bobby Fuller died for your sins.
And I ain't never seen a movie that moved me half as much.
Bobby Fuller died for your sins.
I could be anywhere when I hear that sound. Take me back, pretty baby. Oh, your daddy, he's so alone. Take me back.